This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Shalom. Good afternoon. How many of you need for me to introduce myself? I need a show of hands. Nice. Okay. Here's the deal. Formal introductions are very boring, and they contain the stuff that's not really interesting. So I'll give you my nutshell introduction, then I'll let you ask a few questions, what you really want to know about me. And this is not the Q&A of after. This is the Q&A of before. You'll get the after, you'll get the in-between. Don't worry. Here is the nutshell. I was born almost 71 years ago here in the land of Israel before the state of Israel. I went to school, I went to some more school, got married, had kids, they went to school to some more school. And now I'm at the phase where the oldest of my grandchildren is already ready for the some more school. In all that time, I worked in Jewish education. A large part of it was in the Israeli system. Then, in the year 1988, I managed to discover the most best well-hidden secret from Israelis. And that's that you guys exist out there. And I found out about Jewish life outside of Israel. And I became a shlicha, an emissary for the Jewish Agency in Montreal, Canada. And that had changed my life. And even though I did come back 3.5 years later, I never went back to work at the stuff I did. I went to work for the Jewish Agency. If you ever gave a dollar to Federation, some of it supported me. Thank you. This is no solicitation, just thank you. In all that time within the Jewish Agency, many, many years, since 85 until I retired, I dealt with two major topics. The titles are not important. Two major topics in Jewish education: how to teach about Israel, how to teach about the Holocaust. We are not going to do Holocaust today. It's just Israel. Okay? Israel has mandatory retirement. Did you know about that? Stop me quickly if I talk too much about it, because I can really. It's the smartest system in the world. It retires women before men, when women live like longer. It makes women in this country retire at 62 and men at 67. The only good thing about it is that you know it's coming, and then you can plan for it. And I did. How many of you work in any framework of education? Any, whatever. So you know that the higher up the echelon of education you go, the less education you get to do. Did you find that out? That when you are really up there, they don't even let you see a student? Okay. So I promised myself that as soon as you do budgets and boards and this and that and the other, I promised myself that as soon as I retired, I'll go back to do that which I love, to teach in a classroom. And the thing I love best to do is to teach through literature. Now I need to ask you another question. How many of you truly, truly hated it back in high school and college when the poetry teacher went like, what did the poet mean when? Honestly hated it. Okay, here is my commitment to you. It's not gonna be like that. Okay? And occasionally I'll have to do 1 or 2 minutes like that, and then I'll warn you, I'll hold your hand meanwhile, okay, if you need to. But it's not going to be like that. Beseder, this is me introducing myself. This is who I am, this is what I do. You get 3 questions of stuff you need to know about me, and here is how I suggest you think about it. I need an answer for this question, because with it, this session will be more meaningful for me. I need an answer to this question, because if I don't know that about you, your whole session doesn't make sense to me. Okay? Go. You get 3 questions. Don't waste them. And I'm not giving you my chocolate mousse recipe, so don't ask about that. Yeah. What do you need to know? Nothing? I told you everything? You'll regret it. Yeah. We are going to deal with that while looking at the poetry. And I promise you, the issue, the main question for the first poem we are dealing with is what is lost in translation. Okay? So you're getting like a big answer. Keep the question for something else. What else? What do you need to know about me? Yes, ma'am.
Who's your favorite Israeli poet?
Oy. Real oy, because I'm old. And my son will be very upset with me. But if I really have to do favorites Israelis, Alterman and Leah Goldberg. But there are so many more young, talented ones. But it's like you asked me about my favorite American novel, and because of my age, I'll say A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, you know? And it's like, it's an age thing. You read amazing stuff later, but the thing of the heart is the thing of the heart. Last question. Yes, sir?
What inspired you to study literature?
Now I have to tell you the story. And I think even the people who study with me now for 3, 4, 5, who knows how many years, I'm not sure I told you that. So, Mom, of blessed memory, you don't get to be 71 and still keep your mother in most cases, right? And I was fortunate enough to have her until I was 64, so I really shouldn't complain. Mom was born in Budapest, Hungary, in the year 1924. Sure, Holocaust survivor, the works. She grows up in an Orthodox family. Yes, the kind of Orthodoxy of Central Europe in which you did whatever you needed to do, and yet on the weekday you could go to the opera and the theater and whatever. And she loved Hungarian poetry. Then Holocaust, illegal immigration, la 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 la. And she lands in a British detention camp for illegal immigrants, like many other people. But because she's pregnant with me, they are released pretty fast and sent to a kibbutz. Do I need to explain to anybody what a kibbutz is? Are there Israelis in the room who absolutely need to know which kibbutz, because without that piece of knowledge, they are miserable? Okay, so Israelis have to know that. So it's Kibbutzat Geva in the Valley of Jezel, which at the time that my parents arrive in 46 is already celebrating its 25th anniversary. So these are not your people who waited for Hitler to become Zionists, okay? These are your Ferbrente Litvak socialists from before. And they are all Litvaks. There is nobody who can speak Hungarian. And then after a couple of days, Mom discovers among the youth group a young woman who made Aliyah on her own, not married, not no family yet, also survivor, who speaks Hungarian. And they get together, and the other one, she knows Hebrew. So Mom very shyly asked her, do these people here have poetry like we have back home in Hungary? And this young woman says, as a matter of fact, they do. Said, can you bring me one poem and try to translate to me what it says? And this woman, also long gone by now, Zichrona Livracha, Chaya Raz, must have had a sense there, because she brought my mother a Rachel poem. Rachel is a major poetic voice of the Second Aliyah, and we'll come to her shortly, so I'm not telling you everything about her. But among other things, she was a barren woman. She could not have children. And she has this poem, goes in Hebrew, Ben Lu Hayali, had I had a son. And this woman, Chaya, understood that Mom was miserable. But she wanted her to feel how fortunate she was, because she made it, she was pregnant, she was going to have a baby, and this woman, Ola, did not even have that. And the poem goes, Ben lo haya li yelid katan, had I had a son, little son, shchor teltelim, black of curls, ve'yafe, and beautiful, la 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 la, I would walk with him in the garden, and I will call him Uri, Uri akra lo Uri shili. End of story. What do I get to be called? What is the name of my son? Could I grow up not doing poetry? Like, seriously? It was there. With Mom's milk, always. My sister actually is a poet. I never got to that. Dayeno? Lomdim? Okay. The idea of teaching about Israel through poetry. and literature. Where does that come from? I'm still doing an introduction, but it is leading us into the topic, like everything else I used in my introduction. I'm a Shlicha from Montreal, Canada, in the 80s. I'm looking around. Most of you may remember, and I'm now talking to the people who cannot remember the 80s, back there in the room. So let me tell you, in the 80s, we don't have cell phones. We don't have internet, and we do not even have photocopying machines. Yeah, a letter between Montreal and Israel, a telephone conversation between Montreal and Israel was so costly that I had to curtail the time my kids could speak to my mom. And you remember how we used to have those telephone conversations at the time because it was so costly? Like, I call you a seder. Like, you didn't say a thing on the phone because you were so stressed because of the cost. Imagine on the back, another thing. Do you, any of you looked or saw Israeli newspapers at the time when they came on that transparent paper? They were printed in Tel Aviv and then flown to New York and from New York to Montreal. And we got them like 4 days later, and we were happy because, like, who knew anything better is coming, right? Okay. Imagine on the background of that, beyond missing mom, I also am missing the new things in Israeli literature at the time. So I write a letter to my friends. Hello, letter. I'm explaining. You take a piece of paper and a pencil. Fold it, put it in the envelope, buy a stamp, go to the box on the street corner, and mail it. This is how you mail. And it takes a week. And if your friends respond the same day, and who does, then you'll get an answer in 2 weeks. Fine. We're not complaining. We have no idea anything better is coming. And I write to them, you know, la la la, and they miss it. And please, if you see something very interesting, please buy, send me, I'll pay you when I go back. Don't worry about pay, they say. They buy the books and they send them to me. Books! Hey, lady, back. Books! They don't go in the airplane. They're heavy. They go in a boat through the St. Lawrence River. Honest. 3 months. They're happy. Soon enough, word gets around in Montreal among my Hebrew-speaking friends, the Israelis, of which there are always many, wherever you live. She's got the new books from Israel. So they asked me, Rachel, will you do a chug, which means a circle of reading together? And I said, of course I would, and you guys are thinking book club, right? Don't you dare. Because in book clubs, every member has a copy. And we had one. And they hadn't come around to do photocopying machines yet. So my secretary typed out on that stuff that you did. And then, And lo and behold, we studied, you know? We did. Soon enough, my non-Hebrew speaking friends come to me and say, hey, will you do for us? I said, I'd love to. But I do not have translations. Now, let me tell you a thing about the 80s. I'll do it in a capsule, and I hope you'll understand it. If you don't, tell me, and I'll explain my analogy and metaphor. The 80s is the time in Israeli literature that we discover that there is more to Israeli literature than Amos Oz and Amichai. Okay? David Grossman, first books, 80s. Okay? Savion Liebrecht, Yona Volach. Wow! But I don't have translations into English. Now, anybody here connected to the publishing business? Can you think of a North American publisher in the 80s who will invest money in translating and publishing Israeli literature that is not Amos Oz and Yehuda Amichai? So we did homemade and we studied. And it's from one of the participants in that group that I learned the lesson that made me create actually this first session, the one we are studying today, to which I've added with years and changed a little bit, but the first poem stayed. Okay? She says to me, Rachel, you do not understand what you're doing for us with reading Israeli literature to you. And now, you know, with the nice, not so very politically correct Israeli manner. In the 80s, we did not even know from politically correct. So I said, oh, that's a big deal. You know, I grew up with this literature, so what's exciting? And she said, no, Rachel, you don't get it. How do we Montreal Jews get to learn about Israel? She says, there are three venues. There's Israel from the pulpit. Any rabbonim in the room? Excuse me? It can be very, you know, comes Lech Lecha and whatever, so the rabbi will address. It can be very insightful, not so contemporary. Then there is Israel of fundraising. Oy. Like the more miserable we look, the better it is for the fundraising, right? And then there is Israel of the media, and that had not changed since. There are two main doors for us to enter the media. Either we shoot them or they shoot us. You know? Now says the woman to me, Rachel, when you're reading this literature with us, it's as if you have invited us into your own living rooms. And let us listen to the intimate Israeli discourse. The kind of stuff you guys are saying to each other when we, diaspora Jews, are not listening. That is the deal. This is the invitation. And there is at least one person in the room who had done that and was invited into my living room. And we read literature there. Because this is where the idea came from. Okay? By now I have close to 50 different sessions. For each one of them, I take a topic, connections to the land, like the one we're doing, the image of the other, women voices, biblical motifs, war, peace, remembrance, politics and poetics, help me, students, like with all those topics that we have done, okay? I put the topic in the center, and I start collecting pieces of literature to address it. Being the nasty person that I am, having my main goal to confuse you as much as I can, I will have conflicting pieces of literature. So you can see the variety of voices as if you didn't know that we do not agree on anything. Okay? That is the deal, connections to the land. And we are starting. What was the purpose of the exercise when I created it? I was looking and I was very much under the influence of the time outside of Israel, 85 to 88. And I visited Jewish summer camps and youth movements and adult education and JCCs and synagogues, the works, and day schools, of course, Montreal. I have two Israeli Sabra kids who are graduates of Bialik Montreal. Like, go figure. Okay, but anyway. And I listened to that, again, nutshell kind of story of how we Jews are connected to the land. So now you need to listen very carefully because I'm going to give you that nutshell version. And if I do something that is wrong or not the kind of thing that your kids were offered, that you yourself were offered as you were growing up, stop me. I'm starting. How are we Jews connected to the land? Many, 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 many years ago, our first patriarch, Abraham, went to the land of Israel. He did so because God told him so. Check. And then, yeah, we went and we came or whatever, but we lived there for many, 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 many years. Good life. We had patriarchs and judges and prophets and kings. All true? We had them? Right. Then, cutting short, came that guy, Titus, burned down our temple and sent us away from the country. And we went not to diaspora, that's the new word. We went on exile. We went to Gula. And on exile, we suffered, suffered, suffered. Yeah? Wept, wept, wept. Prayed, prayed, prayed to go back to our land. While we were busy suffering, praying, and weeping, our land lay barren. And it was waiting for us to come back, right? Then came Herzl. He said, oh, look, everybody else, they have a flag and a passport and a land and a government and a coin. We should too. We said, great idea. We all followed him. came to the land, fell on our bended knees, kissed the ground, and we fell in love with it, and we are ever since. Any problem with my story? Is it not the one we were told? Okay, let's check it a little bit. Was it that great in all those years of judges and kings and prophets? Nah. Did we wait for Titus to go out of the land? No. There were Jewish communities in Egypt, in Greece, in Babylon, way before Titus. Did he send all of us on exile in the year 1970? Yeah. We all left in the first century. Then who wrote the Mishnah? Which is written in the second, whatever. We stayed, we lingered for many years. While in the diaspora, was it that bad all the time? Was the land ever barren? Did we all listen to Herzl? Did Herzl listen to Herzl? Did he move here? Even Herzl didn't listen to Herzl. Are we all in love with this country? Come on. Open hearts, you know? We are not. So this session is the oh yay session. Looking at the complexity of that relationship, not from a political point of view, from a personal, individual. Beseder? We're starting with Yehuda Amichai. Why? Because I said Alterman and Leah Goldberg, and of course, like everybody else, I'm in love with Yehuda Amichai. But you know, heart is big, so there's a lot of place. I know that everybody knows who Yehuda Amichai is. I'm talking to the one single person in the room who may have forgotten, okay? Just in case, put the context in. Yehuda Amichai, born to a Jewish observant, probably what we would call today modern Orthodox Jewish family in Germany. I think that had we asked Yehuda Amichai's father whether he was a modern Orthodox, he would look at you and would say, Jewish, you mean, right? Yehuda Amichai is born in the year 24. It's so easy for me to remember. Mom was born in the same year. When he is 12 in the year 1936, the whole family, brothers, sisters, children, cousin, because of Yehuda Amichai's father's sense of need, they leave Germany and come to the land of Israel, to Eretz Israel. And in all of our collective heads, now the collective historical clock is ticking, and we are saying in time. Like many a child of immigrants, Yehuda Amichai wants to out-Sabra every Sabra. So soon enough, because it wasn't mainstream at the time, off goes the kippah, off goes religiosity, off goes the German name, and in 48 we will find him already a fighter in the Palmach during the War of Independence, no kippah. He will continue to be one of the most important, if not the most important, poetic voice of his time. He starts publishing in 62, but we know he started writing earlier. Yehuda Amichai was extremely creative in his poetry and the dullest person for titles of his books. So his first book of poetry that appears in 1962 carries the amazingly creative name Poems. 1948 to 1962. Shirim. You know? Now you know. And his last book, Open, Shut Open, will appear in the year 1995, which is 5 years before he had died. His poetry is individual, national, erotic, if you are not afraid to look behind the words, and many other things. We are reading from his book that appeared in the year 1985, and it has also a very original name, Poems of Jerusalem. It appeared, I think it had like probably 10 or 12 editions since it appeared for the first time. When it was first published, it was published in the shape of what you call coffee table books, and it had three languages, Hebrew, English, and photography. And that one is not available anymore. You'll have to go eBay if you want it, because the only copy I have, I'm not giving you. There is a new version without the photography on Amazon. It has the poetry, but not the photography of the first edition from 85. I'd like to do many things with this poem because it's our entry to the complexity of our connectedness to this place, and in particular to Jerusalem. The first thing I'd like to do is for you to just hear a reading through of the whole poem in Ivrit. And then we'll do all the discussion in English. But before I do that, no, I'll read it to you. מתוך שירי ארץ ציון וירושלים. ירושלים מקום שהכל זוכרים ששכחו בו משהו, אך הם אינם זוכרים מה שכחו. ולצורך זכירה זו אני חובש על פניי את פני אבי. זוהי עירי שבה מתמלאים כלי חלומותיי כמו מיכלי חמצן של צוללים לצלול. הקדושה בה הופכת לפעמים לאהבה, והשאלות ששואלים בהרים האלה נשארו כתמיד. ראית את הצון שלי? ראית את הרועה שלי? ודלת ביתי פתוחה כמו קבר שמתוכו קמו לתחייה. And now I will need two volunteers, so listen up. I need somebody who has fluent Hebrew and English, obviously, that I'm assuming. Okay? So I would like you, do you have a copy of the text, sir? And are you a rabbi? That's good, because I need a one-word answer. And you know, I don't want the I don't need the it depends shiur now. I need a simple, straight, yes or no answer. So this is why I checked. I'm inviting you to look at the title of the poem in Hebrew and the title of the poem in English. And I'm asking you, because you told me you had fluent Hebrew, is the No. Hebrew. Do you have fluent Hebrew, ma'am? Betach. I'm inviting you, therefore, to look at the title of the poem in Ivrit and in English. And you're not a rabbi.
Not yet.
And I'm asking you to give me a simple answer. Is the translation of the title correct?
No.
Todah rabah. No. It's an incorrect translation. While it was done by Chana Bloch of blessed memory, we are barely out of the Shloshim. She passed. She passed just recently. It was the night I had the previous session here.
That was the day. Trump.
That was the day. Anyway. And she knew Amichai, and she has perfect Hebrew and perfect English. And yet. Now I need somebody, listen carefully, who is comfortable in the Jewish way of life. By that I mean, you know the major stuff we do. I'm not checking how many times you show up for shul, but you know, like, you can tell a Kaddish from a Kiddush, you know, that kind of person. You have been in the major ceremonies and events. Yet you have no Hebrew. Is there somebody like that? Comfortable in the Jewish way of life, no Ivrit. Come on. Very little Ivrit. Okay. So we are going to... And are you ready to have a conversation with me, sir? Yes. I'm going to read to you the Hebrew title. Now, I told you I was born in this country. I'm a 71-year-old Sabra. I have perfect Hebrew, and you don't. I don't want you to translate. I know the translation. I want you to do something else for me. I want from you to listen to the title and tell me if it rings a bell. If the sound reminds you of anything. Is that a good deal? Can we do that? Listen up. Mishirei Eretz Tzion veYerushalayim. Does it remind you of anything?
Yeah.
Him. What? No? No? Anybody else? No. Eretz Zion v'Yerushalayim batikva. Amichai in the title makes a clear allusion to the national anthem. And by that, if you know Amichai, you can say he is gonna have a correspondence with important stuff. Knowing Amichai better, he's going to mess with important stuff. Now look at the work of Chana Bloch, Zichrona Livracha. when she gives the English title? What did she do for the American reader? An allusion to America the Beautiful, okay? So, yeah, doesn't work with Australians. I know, I've tried. Hardly with Canadians, but for Americans, it works. There is a clear allusion to a national anthem-like American song. You said that? So actually, the translator, we're just having a conversation. They happen to be here. This is all for you. The translation is a cultural adaptation. It's a work of art in its own right. And questions that arise when you have a beautiful translation will lead you to a richer, different, whatever reading, yet there is stuff lost in translation. Okay? So we have established that, and we are starting to read the poem. Jerusalem is a place where everyone remembers he has forgotten something but doesn't remember what it is. Oh, yeah. Do you need to be a biblical scholar in order to, when you see the first three lines of a Hebrew Jewish poem, including the words Jerusalem, remembering and forgetting, do you need to be a biblical scholar to realize that Amichai may be making an allusion to a slightly earlier text, like 3,000 years earlier text? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem. Now pay attention. Because in that Psalms quote, as we believe by David, we have made, or David made in our name, the most serious commitment, like God forbid, chas v'chalila, I should forget Yerushalayim, may my tongue dry up and my arm wither, terrible stuff should happen to me, should I chas v'chalila forget. And here comes Yehuda Amichai, at the end of the 20th century, and he's saying, I'm not so sure anymore. There are people who come here to this town, look around, and they may have the feeling, I know I ought to feel something, I know I ought to remember something. Have no idea. And my question to you, be courageous, not politically correct. Who is Amichai talking about? Who are those people who, when they come to Yerushalayim, have a sense that I ought to, but it's not happening?
Secular Jews?
Huh? Secular Jews. What is Amichai?
German Jews,
yeah.
People outside Israel.
Diaspora Jews. This is a classical Israeli critique of diaspora Jews, just like we have in the... No. No. Okay. You know what happens when I teach this in Ivrit in Yerushalayim? Anybody who knows Israel well enough can give me a guess what happens when I teach this in Ivrit in Yerushalayim and I ask the question, who does he address this to? What do they tell me? Tel Aviv people, of course. And I, needless to say, come from Tel Aviv. Okay? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, the people born here already, the new generation of Israelis.
They don't get it.
This is 85.
Amichai is talking about these Sabras. Who take it for granted. Mm-hmm. Maybe. But Amichai does a step further. He is actually talking about himself. Look at the next line. And for the sake of remembering, I who fought in all the wars, I who write poetry in the language of the poets, who can make allusion to Tehillim as well as to Hatikva, I need to go out of my way to do something for the sake of remembering. And for the sake of remembering, I wear my father's face over mine. Oi, I'll tell you why this is oi. Amichai's father is a diaspora Jew. And Amichai, the already Selbstgemacht, became Sabra, is saying, I do not get this place unless I connect to the way my father understood it, his eyes, his nose, his sense, whatever. So I need to ask you now the reverse question. What do diaspora Jews have over us Israelis? That Amichai needs his father's eyes and sense and nose to better understand this. Yes. Ah, you have the ah. We don't. Yeah.
I think the fantasy of what Jerusalem.
The longing, the fantasy, the ah. Anything else? Yeah.
Being outsiders,
like Agnon said once, I envy you because you're leaving the country. You'll have the outside look. Yeah.
And not feeling the day to day that.
You guys rush from the supermarket to the kindergarten of the kids to be picked up, and you do your reserve duty, and you stop by the bank, and we complain about parking. You're losing it. You're not getting it anymore. Huh? Here comes the crucial question. But there are enough people who live in Israel to get this, and even the others, you have enough Israeli acquaintances and family. How popular does this make Amichai? By suggesting to an Israeli readership that you need the diaspora point of view to better get your connection to the place. Okay. Is there maybe, be honest with me, one person in the room who is meeting Amichai poetry for the first time? I'm glad to have the privilege to give you that entrance, and I'd like for you to remember that the first thing that you remember about Amichai and that you were taught about Amichai, that he doesn't care about being popular, okay? And he will say it in a beautiful language. Take this moment as a gift from him via me. I say that? Oy, but now, so we know why he needs this. Any Hebraists in the room that want a connection to the particular verb structure in Hebrew that will help you get a deeper sense? Anybody who has enough Hebrew for that? Yes. Look at the Hebrew. No, I'll come to the Chovesha. I spent 15 minutes with the Chovesh. Hang on. I want to look at Ulitzorech Zechirazo. Zechira. Zechira is the hard work of remembering. It's not like, remind me quickly, it's not zikaron, it's not tazkirli. Amichai knows that there is a job to be done. Zechira. Ani chovesh al panai, I wear my father's face over mine. And now the moment, the classical moment of Jewish education, when I pull on you the oldest, most effective trick of Jewish education, guilt. I'll make you feel guilty for not having Hebrew like you wouldn't believe. I wear my father's face over mine. In English, you wear your socks, shoes, slacks, glasses, hat, jewelry, and I hear recently even your perfume, right? Ladies, you wear your perfume. In Hebrew, bless the language. You gorev your socks, noel your shoes, lovesh your slacks, chovesh your kova, markiv your glasses, odeh your jewelry, and for perfume we don't have, so there's always Yiddish for spritz. This is what we do. Now, Amichai wants to put something new on his face. Normal people do not put other faces on their face. And he lives in a culture that has a particular verb for every single item you put on your body. So he looks at the plethora of verbs available to him, and he chooses the verb chovesh, the one you use to cover your head. Is Amichai the secular suggesting, hello, man, you want to understand the city, look like a Jew, cover your head, do Jewish, you know? Like, look like a Jew at least when you are here. But that's not enough. Yeah.
I may be remembering wrong, but I was just reviewing the Parsha, and is Chovesh the word to saddle donkey, or am I mixing it up?
Kibush. Chaf.
Okay,
in another class, we are not doing settlements today. No way.
And not medic.
Coming to that. Hebrew verbs normally have three letters. There are exceptions with two or four. We are not doing grammar today.
Levach, when you said
Chet Bet, I know. Chet Bet Shin is also the root for the word that suggests paramedic. And some of you may have still traveled in Israel at the time when we needed paramedics on the bus, and they were called Chovesh. So the verb includes the idea of dressing a wound, of healing. But if I wanted to take you to the beginning of the 20th century, to probably one of the greatest Hebrew poets, not Israeli, Hebrew, Chaim Nachman Bialik, he will refer to yeshiva students by saying, Chovesh et safsalei Beit HaMidrash, dresses the benches of yeshiva, namely studying. And if I took you all the way back to Yirmiyahu, you want me to say Jeremiah? I will, but it's hard on my tongue. Yirmiyahu. He will talk about Chavush Bevet HaAsurim, committed to prison. Anybody did IDF here? They call prison in the military Machbosh to this day, from the same verb. So the Hebrew use of Ani Chovesh, I wear, my father's face over mine, contains in the Hebrew the meaning of, do Jewish, heal, study, commit. How do they say in nice, beautiful American movies? I rest my case. I started with that. I started with that. Cover your head. Okay. That was the first one. Do Jewish. Okay. Let's continue with the idea of wearing your father's face over yours in order to get a better understanding. I'd like to suggest a very mundane reading, and then I'll suggest a deeper one from Jewish sources. Let me do the mundane. I'm looking around me, and I know you don't make age comments, but I'm not blind. So there must be at least one more person in the room beyond me who have already reached the point when you passed by a window or a mirror and you glanced and there was your mom looking at you or your dad. Must have happened already to some of you. Yeah. The first time is extremely upsetting. Like, what is mom doing in my bathroom every morning? But then later on in life, it's less upsetting. Is Amichai suggesting that you need to mature in order to get the city? That you need already to have a face like your father's? The young don't really get it. You need to have accumulated experience. That is a reading. But I'd like to suggest another, the deeper one. Just the expression, because in Hebrew the exact words count. Pnei Avi. Now I'm looking for rabbi scholars, students of Jewish text. Pnei Avi. Where does that come from?
Isaac was supposed to look exactly like Abraham?
The expression Pnei Avi. Yeah.
Yosef.
When the Midrash says, how did he stand the temptation of Eshet Potiphar? Niglu lo pnei aviv. The face of his father was shone to him. So from that moment on, from that midrash on, we know that the face of your father stands for the litmus test of proper behavior, of proper attitude. Is Amichai not saying that Shehechiyanu have reached a moment when niglu li pnei avi, where I can see things like my father? Last but not least, the word panim in itself. In English, face, facade. Facade from the Latin is outside. And panim in Hebrew? Where does panim come from? What's the other word of the same root? Pnim, inside. The Hebrew language recognizes that your face is nothing but the reflection of your inside. And all that is, and for the sake of remembering, I wear my father's face over mine. Can the English carry all that? No matter how talented Hannah Bloch was, it cannot. Now we have reached a moment in the poem which is like, wow, okay? As soon as you have put your father's face over yours, and everything becomes crystal clear. This is the city where my dream containers fill up like divers' oxygen tanks. Is there a scuba diver in the room? Isn't it wonderful that it's only women? Okay. I love, yes, okay, Besedio. And all four of us, there is a mistake in the poem. What do we carry in those tanks when we go underwater?
Air,
compressed air, not oxygen. You cannot breathe oxygen. Oxygen is what they give you in hospital. When your breathing is not so great, they'll give you a little bit extra. Okay? So we learned the second thing about Amichai. He was no scuba diver. Now I need to make my public confession, and I'll make it as long as I can, because you cannot be more stupid than I was on that occasion. Many, many, many years ago, I'm going to say 90s, I used to work for the Jewish Agency at a place called Kiryat Moria here in Yerushalayim. And a colleague, not me, I wish I could take credit, but I couldn't, organized a professional development day. And to conclude the day, she had invited Yehuda Amichai to read to us some poetry. Huh? Nice. Cannot do that anymore. And he didn't read this poem. He read another one that I teach on other occasions. It's about the First Intifada. And at the end, when it was all, you know, falling apart, I did that. I couldn't invent it. I went up to him and said, Mr. Amichai, in that other poem about Yerushalayim, you had made a mistake. It's not oxygen, it's compressed air. I did that. The only thing I can say for myself is that I was 22 years younger. But still, you know, like, how stupid can you be? You have the occasion to ask Amichai a question, and you do that? Man looks at me pitifully, which is exactly what I had deserved. And he says, who cares? The Hebrew is even less polite, like, my chpatli. Like, shit. It's so much more beautiful like this. Ze kol kach harbe yoter yafe kacha. So that sent me back to the poem. And I realized, as if I didn't know how right he was. And now I need for you just to listen. The word for oxygen in Hebrew is chamtsan. Chamtsan. And the line, diverse oxygen tanks, in the original Hebrew is kmo mechale chamtsan shel tzolelim litzlol. He wanted the tzelele sound, which in Hebrew spells go deep, listen, tzlil, and the reminiscent of another very famous Israeli song of the time of Yerarim, tzalul, kayayin, see-through, transparent. And I wanted him to say avir d'chos, like, you know, compressed air. When he did that through the sounds of the Hebrew, you will see how quickly I came to regret that question. Now, this is the one moment when I do literature teacher-like. So if anybody needs to take a deep breath, it will take one moment. In poetry, there are structures, and one of them is called sonnets. Sonnets have 14 lines. and this is one. Even if the printing here shifted, trust me, the original has 14 lines. In sonnets, traditionally, when you reach the middle of the sonnet, there'll be a shift in mood. And Amichai is true to his art. And we reach the center of the sonnet, and now comes the shift. And what shift? What shift? We just had a moment of, wow, I now get it. I need it like air, like the sound, like the transparency of things, etc. And as soon as he got that moment of clarity, here is your classical, if you know your Amichai, stepping aside, looking back at your work and saying an Amichai sentence. His holiness sometimes turns into love. What? What? Because if you say that, then I could think that its holiness sometimes turns into hatred. Its holiness sometimes turns into indifference. Its holiness sometimes could turn into anger. You're opening a whole set of options that I was not ready to entertain. I wanted you, Amichai, to take me, you know, that main street of the wow thing. No. Also note the connectedness between Hakdusha ba, the holiness in it, in Hebrew, its holiness, hofechet lif'amim le'ahava, turns sometimes into love. And if you think in your Jewish experience, and I remember myself getting this poem for teaching, ready for teaching for the first time. It was a big year. I'll brag. When the Board of Governors of the Jewish Agency used to meet, the Education Committee, which was our board because I was in the Education Department, normally started with Dvar Torah. And that year, the Director General of the Department took the courage, and he said, we'll do Israeli poetry for Dvar Torah. And Rachel, will you do it? I'm like, you know, and I'm choosing this poem. I had to do it in 10 minutes, not like 30 as we are doing here. And I reach these lines, 6 words in English, 5 in Hebrew. And I have this sense that many Israelis like myself have, because we were not raised observant. I know that the connectedness between Kedusha and Ahava is not something that Amichai had invented. I know enough for that. I know it's in text. But I do not know where is it from. So like many secular people, we also have our rabbis. And mine at the time was Dr. Dubi Goldflam, who used to work for the Torah Education Department. Because if we can divide something, why not divide? Okay. So I called Dubi in Kiryat Moriah. I'm too lazy to walk over. He's in the next building. And I said, Dubi, I'm reading Amichai and I need your help. So what are you calling me? You are the Amichai maven. He said, no. Listen up. There is these lines. There's a shift from Kedusha le'ahava. Where does that come from? And he answers like a classical Israeli that he is. Birkat Kohanim, kamuvan, kol echad yodeh et zeh. Like the priest blessing, everybody knows that. So thank you to Darabadu. Now I know as well. Beseder. Let's go back to Birkat Kohanim. And I'm going to be very literal. What happens at Birkat Kohanim? Mr. Kaplan, the physician, and Mr. Katz. Is it a conservative synagogue? Mrs. Kahana as well? No? No, okay. I hope it's mixed so you have Sfardim, so Mr. Azulai as well, right? Are standing on the bima. They cover themselves with talitot, which you call talisin for some reason, but it's talitot. They cover themselves with talitot and they say the following. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam shekidshanu bekedushato shel ahar. They start by recognizing the amazing gift of Kedusha that was handed to them throughout the generations, all the way from Aharon, the first Kohen, because Jews have kept their Kohanim names, the Kaplans and the Kahanas and the Katzes and the Azulais. What a thing to know about yourself. As soon as they have recognized and given gratitude, Baruch Ata, for that, comes the second part. V'tzivanu levarech et amcha Yisrael v'ahava. And commanded upon us to bless this congregation with love. Kedusha you get. Ahava you need to give. Ahava is from you. Kedusha you're giving, either you have it or not. Ahava needs to come from you. And Amichai recognizes this tension. I know the city is holy. Can I love it every single day? Sometimes. And he opens the gate. This is 85. You didn't even dare think about criticizing Israel at that time. You didn't even know how to spell J Street. They didn't know how to spell J Street. And Amichai in Israel already is opening the discourse and saying, I am committed. Don't tell me that I am a hateful Jew, self-hating Jew and all that beautiful language that I get occasionally. I know it's holy. I just showed you through my father, through Tehillim, through David, through Atikva. I know. But don't tell me to love every single thing that happens here. I cannot. Sometimes. And by opening that gate, he had given us as early as 32 years ago the permission to multiple narratives, to looking at things and say, I know it's holy, I'm committed, it's mine, but let's get it right. So I can love it more days of the year, okay? Now the time is 3:30, and I haven't finished this, so I'll go quickly through the rest. It's your homework to do it more seriously until next we meet, because I really want to do some other stuff with you. The questions that are asked in these hills are the same as they have always been. Have you seen my sheep? Have you seen my shepherd? And the door of my house stands open like a tomb where someone was resurrected. Two questions. First of all, the equation of sheep and shepherd in Jewish and universal discourse can suggest three, at least, levels. Here in Jerusalem, occasionally, you will see the real shepherd and the real sheep, smelly and baba. It still happens. And that quest of the nomad, Bedouin, whatever, still happens. Sheep and shepherd have always been an analogy, a metaphor for the people and their leader. And it's an ongoing question in this country and yours. When you look at your leader, say, hello, do you still see me? And they should maybe wonder occasionally whether we still follow them. And no contemporary intention is intended here, okay? And sheep and shepherd, of course, are the ultimate relationship between God Almighty and us, his people. And it does happen in this city and in these hills that will turn our eyes and say, you still there? You still see us? You still hear me? And we are hoping that he from high above will look and say, I still watch you. I'm still here for you. And it's always there, this three-level discourse. The enigmatic thing in this poem is the last two lines. V'delet beiti pituha kemo kever shemitocho kamo litchiyah. And the door of my homestay opens as a tomb where someone was resurrected. Why would a person want to equate their home to a tomb? What did Amichai mean? I told you, 1 minute, it will happen. Is it a Cook reading, Rabbi Cook? That the mere fact that you have a home in Jerusalem and its door is open is already the beginning of Geulah? Maybe, I don't know. But that's not the largest enigma. The largest enigma is the tension between the original and the translation. The Hebrew says, "Kemo kever shemitocho kamu litchiyah," plural. resurrection. That's Jewish. At the end of days, when Mashiach comes, we shall all rise. And the English says, where someone was raised, oy vey. That's anything but Jewish. Did Amichai not know? Did Chana Bloch not know? Did Amichai intentionally wanted the English to be open to a more universal, maybe also Christian reading? You know why? I will never know. What did I waste my question on? And this is my punishment, because I was planning on my next visit to Berkeley to look up Chana Bloch and ask her, but she died too. So it's an ongoing punishment for a moment of stupidity. I'll accept it and stay with the enigma. Comments, question on this before we turn the page for the next one? Okay. Yala. Let's do Rachel. Rachel, who did have a last name, it's Blubstein. But nobody says it, because at her time, she is probably one of the most famous poetic voice of the early waves of immigration. The second and the third Aliyah. I will explain why we count her in both. She was so famous that, I'm sorry for the comparison, like Madonna, you don't need a last name. She makes Aliyah to the land of Israel in the year 1909, which is the middle of the second Aliyah, the second wave of modern Zionist immigration, which is less traditional than the first one. The first Aliyah, you know, it's families, they are Orthodox, they do your Gedera and Rosh Pina and whatever, and they settle, and immediately they build the shul and the school and whatever. The second Aliyah is very different. The second Aliyah is those young people who run away from home, from yeshiva, from shtetl, up with the kippah, and you're going to make the new Jew, and you're going to be pioneers and work the land, and get suntanned, and defend yourself. Very important to get suntanned in the second Aliyah, okay? And you'll really make the new Jew. And Rachel belongs to those. And she will join the first kibbutz, the Ganya. And then they will send her to study agronomy in France. And World War I will happen, and she cannot come back. So she will go back to her hometown, Rostov, in southern Russia, and work in a Jewish children's orphanage and contract tuberculosis. By the time she is ready to come back in 1919, after World War I, on the first boat of immigrants, the Ruslan, starting the third Aliyah, so actually she makes Aliyah twice. The Ruslan, I'm still planning to do for 2019, a session about the people who were on the Ruslan. It's a little bit like the Mayflower. There are more people who claim they have been on the Ruslan than the boat could possibly carry, but some are extremely interesting, so Rachel is on that. Rabin's mother was on the Ruslan, and I could continue and continue, it's interesting. So she makes Aliyah, she wants to come back to the kibbutz, she cannot because of the tuberculosis, meanwhile there are children. She dies a very tragic death at a young age. Rachel's poetry is her total commitment to the land of Israel. You cannot be more committed to Israel than Rachel. And one of her most famous poems is called El Artsi, To My Land. And it talks about, I haven't sung you enough, my country. Look her up. I haven't glorified your name enough. That poem is to be found in every school reader. It has an endless number of renditions. It's still on Israeli radio. We all know it. You have to be a Rachel Korazim Nudge to look up Oh My Land, which she writes the same year, which was never set to music, which is not taught in schools, because there is a diversion from Main Street pioneers. So we are going to read this slowly and remember that this in our collective Zionist memory is the most committed to the land person, and yet The year 1920, both poems, 1920. She will die 10 years later, in 1930. Oh, my land, my parent. Oy, how Russian. You know, in Russian poetry, the country is your mother. Ho, Artsy, Horati. Really, you can already hear the drums or whatever. Why is your landscape so blighted and gloomy? Oy! Like Rachel is sitting probably on a hilltop next to the Kinneret, looking around. It's miserable. No trees, no green, no shade, no other kibbutzim. I'm afraid to use the word settlement, but I will. I just mean a place where people settle, okay? So leave the politics out. Nothing. And she starts her poem in the first two lines and says, oh, Mom, honestly, you are my mother, but are you ugly? Okay. And she looks around and it's miserable. And then look what happens. The memory of a stepmotherland imperceptibly creeps into the heart. Oy. I don't want to. Mom, but it's happening. The memory of a stepmotherland. Who is stepmotherland? Russia. Rachel Bluestein, the poetic voice of the second Aliyah, the same Aliyah of Ben-Gurion, Weizmann, should I continue? Is homesick for pogrom Russia? Is that at all kosher? Can you see why this is never published? Can you see the struggle? I don't want it to happen, but it creeps into the heart. And now that the door was opened, the memory. Upon the hillside, the sprightly fir tree. On the plain, the ancient oak. On the slopes, on the shores of the stream, the birch maidens in their Shabbat garb. The fact that you can see all these trees is very clear. In the barrenness of the Galilee at the time, she is missing the fir tree, the oak tree, the birch. But look at something interesting, what she weaves in this stanza. The second Aliyah, the majority, not everybody, but the majority, is a one-generational Aliyah. It's young people who break away from home, leave cheder and shtetl and yeshiva and family behind to create a new life. The majority are young men, very few women. Rachel came with her sister, though. So by comparing the fir tree to pirchachei ashuach, sprightly pirchachim, ill-behaved young people, ancient oak, yeshishei alone, like grandpa, and the young woman, her friends, her sisters, her cousins, who dress up in white for Shabbat, like the birch tree, which is white, in case you didn't know. So Rachel makes one single memory or longing by combining the longing for the multi-generational community or family and the longing to the shady trees. And now that the door was open, she cannot stop it. Let me tell you about the forest. The arm of the sun is too short to cast its fiery lance into the heart of the forest. A whole day in the abode of pines, scented darkness and a dream. Want to tell you about forest? I'll tell you. Back there, stepmotherland. The forest was so thick that even in the middle of the day, the sun rays could not penetrate. The arm of the sun is too short to cast its fiery lance into the heart of the forest. The sun rays cannot penetrate. Can you quickly tell me what the woman is missing mainly in this country? Shade. I was already committed to start thinking about a whole session about the role of shade. Amichai has amazing shade references, and I always say the only place in America where I teach this and they totally get it is Arizona. I actually did in Phoenix, and they totally get it. As soon as she had done the unthinkable and undoable and unspeakable, she let herself be homesick to pogrom Russia. She starts to rein in her horses and behave like a proper pioneer, kibbutznikit, okay? Oh, my mother, surely we yearn for you. Surely we will claim your abuse from God. And as in former times, you will again spread fragrance and shade over those stricken by your noontime heat. If all the endeavors of the pioneers were to be successful, if all their prayers were to be answered, what will Israel look like? In Rachel's poem, if everything was okay, God willing, it will look like Russia. And by virtue of this naive, innocent poem to me, I think it rises beyond an Israeli poem to a universal immigrant poem. No matter how old country was horrible, it was home. And you came to the new country and you wanted to be accepted to the new country. And you fought for it and you struggled and sometimes you cheated. And sometimes you sneaked in like my parents and whatever. And there was Holocaust over there. And still for my mother, there was no theater ever to match the Budapest theater. And no peach will taste the same as in her childhood. And immigrants, as soon as they settle, what do? Little Italy, little Tokyo, a little bit of a shtetl on the Lower East Side, etc. And I love this poem because it is not taught in Israeli schools. Because this voice is not heard. We are not to know that our courageous, pioneering fathers and mothers were human beings who were homesick. And they miss the shtetl, and they miss family, and they miss shade. Questions, comments? Yes, ma'am.
They miss fragrance, too.
Oh, yeah, sure, the smells of home. Absolutely.
But here, you get fragrance and shade now, yeah. She's talking about.
We'll be here, yeah. We'll make it smell like Russia, even. Okay, thank you for that. I haven't noticed it. Thank you. Could I trouble one of you to pour me a little bit of water in one of those glasses? Thank you. They actually have one. Sorry. All right. We are approaching. Yes, sir.
Do you think Rachel thought others felt like her, and this was to give some justification for their feelings of homesickness, or was this a personal journey?
I'm trying to think of a date when somebody dealt with that, because there is a book by Muki Tzur, who is a great, I would say, secular Jewish culture educator here in Israel. By that I don't mean, what do they mean exactly when they say secular, because he's totally fluent in text and whatever. And he did the research, I'll say already about 20 or 30 years ago, about correspondence and letters and poetry of the chalutzim, of the pioneers. Oh, they miss home. Like you wouldn't believe how they missed home. But we never let that voice heard in the mainstream. Push down. We all love, you know, fall on a bended knee, kiss the land, love it to death. Okay. We are going to your next page, 3 out of 5. And in order to do that, I'm going to discuss the name of the writer. And we will do that by me telling you something about his last name and then asking you something about his first name. Okay? So get ready. The name of the poem is Galut, which means exile, but I wanted the word Galut to stay there, as Balfour Chakak had written it. Okay? Chakak is a classical, traditional, Jewish, Iraqi family last name. The Iraqi Jewish community, probably the oldest outside of Israel, from the times of the first exile counts its roots to that time, and many of its members had kept original Hebrew biblical names. Chakak is one of them, Chet Kuf Kuf, which would carry two meanings, the one who gives the law or the one who carves in stone. Doesn't matter, because in ancient times, laws are carved in stone. It's the same activity. What a name to have. Could you say the same about the first name, Balfour? Biblical? Ancient? Iraqi? No. Okay. So we need, you got it right. So we need to explore this. If I was to tell you, and I will, that in the year 1948, a gentleman in Baghdad, Iraq, has the amazingly wonderful, fortunate event in his life. He has two healthy twin boys born to him. And he calls one of them Balfour and the other Herzl. He does. What does that tell you about that gentleman? He's very Zionist, okay? I'm going to use one foul word. And to hell with what the kids will have to go through in school with these names, you know? Like, who cares? The Chakak family makes Aliyah in the early 50s with the rest of the Baghdad Jewish community. Should I tell you about the welcoming committee? All Ashkenazim, all looking down on immigrants from Muslim countries as well. You know, after the Holocaust and what had happened, okay, fine. They're sprayed against insects. Horrible. I do not think that the Chakak twins remember anything of that because they were too young, 3 or 4. So the fact that in the 80s, Balfour Chakak can publish a poem like this tells me that the story trickles down in the family, that he grew up hearing about this, okay? Because there is no way he can remember it. This particular poem, unlike the first two we have read, does not have an official translation. It was done for me by Shulamit Berman, who used to be my secretary, administrative assistant when I worked at the Jewish Agency. She's from Efrat, and she does not have an official translator's diploma, so she never puts her name down, and therefore I always find an opportunity to mention her and to be grateful to her every single time she again gives me the opportunity to do this teaching. And she's South African, so occasionally you will find non-American ways of saying things. It's Shulamit. I love it the way it is. My grandfather's priestly garments were transparent, his mother embroidered the hem of his blue robe with beautiful gold bands. She took pleasure etching his name in letters of silver pure light. My grandfather, Murad ben Rafael Chakak. So if I am doubtful whether Balfour Chakak can remember his grandfather, I am twice as doubtful that he can remember his great-grandmother. It's a story. Maybe grandpa told it, maybe mom told it, maybe dad. You know, we used to have those flimsy transparent layers over the dress, and they were always embroidered, like the beauty of that time. But look at the insistence on the name. The name of my grandfather was Murad, son of Rafael Chakak. Abba, these are names in our family, not your Balfour, thank you very much. Grandpa had a real Iraqi Jewish name. Why do I have to schlep with that Balfour thing? Okay? I'm at least hearing this conversation with grandpa over the head of father who gave me that name. And now the even stronger, in your face, Abba. Like Avraham from Ur, my grandfather came up, Allah made Aliyah from that same land in the same manner. Hello, Abba. Zionism in our family is not based on Altneuland or the Balfour Declaration. Grandfather's Zionism depended on a book, on a text slightly earlier than Altneuland, as in Lech Lecha, maybe. Is being a Zionist so important when you come from our background? That's the true Zionism. And look at again at the translation, where it says in English, he came from the same land in the same manner. The original is Meota Eretz al Pioto Dibur. Not the Dibur, yeah, could be manner, but also the word. And the words hiding here are Lech Lecha. Okay, this is why my grandfather came to this land. He came to the same homeland, no longer did he have his gorgeous robe. His supremacy was gone, his face shone with grief, the silver was tarnished, and the gold butchered. Those of you who can, please look at the Hebrew. The two possibilities of writing nishchat. Nishchat with a taf for the tarnished, and nishchat with the tet for the butchered. Okay? So the Hebrew has a sound element here that the English, unfortunately, cannot carry. My grandfather was a peddler in the markets, selling his treasures. Tattered clothing, second-rate merchandise, slow of speech, a forsaken prophet. Do we need any particular explanations for slow of speech and prophet who did not really make it into the land? Can you therefore think about the experience the child seeing his grandfather, the adult poet? I mean, his father must have had 100% fluency in biblical text. He actually knew Hebrew. Why is he slow of speech? Why is he not understood? Because just like his robe, which looks probably weird to those Israelis of the 50s, so does his accent, Iraqi accent of the Hebrew. He probably has better Hebrew than all those Polaks, okay? And yet he becomes slow of speech, forsaken prophet. My grandfather was a sorrowful king. And I'm thinking Saul, I'm thinking Chizkiyahu, whatever. He was born to silken garments, embroidery, and fine raiment. But when he was exiled to the land, oy vey, v'kasher gala el eretz. Where was homeland? Where was home? Baghdad. Where is exile? Ramat Gan, where many Iraqi went. What a statement to make by twisting the two words, not gala me eretz, ela gala el eretz. And the whole thing, they never made it home. They never entered. But when he was exiled to the land, his clothes were spoiled and his splendor ruined. When he died, they draped him in his shroud like a splendid robe, the talit he received from his father, his inheritance, was etched with the blue letters of holiness. Along the whole length of the talit, I thought I could see beautiful bands of gold, pure light. Sabashili, Murad beRafael Chakak. According to Balfour Chakak, the generation of his grandfather, when did they actually connect to the land?
When they died.
They were buried. They were never had a chance to properly make it their own. As we are finishing and I'm making my closing remarks, I would like to very highly recommend, if you can do it, and it's coming slowly into English, to start looking up Mizrahi Sephardi modern Israeli poetry, a lot of which is translated into English, because now is the generation of the grandchildren and even their children who are finding their poetic voice and making it mainstream in Israel, unlike the atmosphere that Balfour Chakak captures here in this poem. I'll take a question or a comment or whatever, because I promise you, you'll have the Q&A of after. So I'm giving it to you. Yes, sir. Yes.
Why is his garment transparent?
There were layers of transparent over the blue normally. Okay? They were not see-through. There were just this decorative transparent thing over it, which made the welcoming committee laugh even louder. Like, what is it, a woman? You know, kind of thing. Yeah, Purim? Yes.
I just want to say that poetry is extremely difficult to understand. And you made it.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you. They made it beautiful. We just read it. Thank you. I'm glad. Now, I'm going to ask an honest confession from the people who are studying with me many times. How many times did you hear this session? You didn't? In our classes? You must have. Come on. Not one of these? Yes. You did. Yeah. Listen. Okay, I'm glad. Yes, sir.
Was Chakak taught in the schools?
Oh, yeah. By the time I discovered his poetry in the 90s, over 20 years ago, he was actually already the chairman of the Association of Poets and Writers in Israel.
So there was no problem?
No. He is totally mainstream.
And even though it's uncomfortable for some Israelis to read.
So, you know, we Amichai told you it's okay to be uncomfortable.
Right, but you said that they wouldn't read this poem by Rachel
because pioneers are not supposed to be homesick.
Yeah.
And now on top of that, be homesick to Baghdad. Mele to Europe, but to Baghdad? I mean, there is a limit, right? Okay. You need to read Eli Amir with his beautiful Baghdad-related novels available in English. Yeah.
It's particularly poignant to us because of the story of the Mizrahi Aliyah and the, as we say in the U.S., it's cringeworthy. But isn't it fair to say that this is the story of every immigrant to every new culture? That it's always going to be the second or third generation before they really reap the benefits?
Yes and no. I happen to be connected to many of those very strong Mizrahi voices now who do not let us get away with this statement and will say, on top of that, there was the racism of the European towards the Oriental, the light skin towards the dark skinned, the one of us towards the not one of us kind of thing. So I'm not, because my friends do not let me get away with it, I'm not letting you get away with it. Okay, I carry the tradition from my friends. Yeah.
There was a book published in the States, maybe you heard, familiar with it, The Man in the White Shark Skin Suit, which the story of
Glaniaro, from Egypt, Cairo.
I look it up. Thank you for. Yeah, there's lots of Mizrahi literature.
Lisette Glaniaro.
Okay.
Tells of a similar experience.
There are many, yeah, absolutely. I just, when discussing connection to the land, as I told you, I wanted you to be exposed to as much of the conflicting voices that we have here on that theme. Yeah, I think we are done. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your program.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.